Hey, what's happening? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. It is Monday, January 26th. How the hell are you guys? This episode is brought to you by my brand new sponsor. I love these guys. I'm so fired up. Shot NYC. Yes, Shot. They are the kings of rock and roll, man. There is not one rocker that has not owned a Shot leather jacket in their life. Everyone. Bruce Springsteen, cover of Born to Run, Shot. Ramones, Shot. I mean, everyone. I could sit here and name off all the people ever to wear a Shot leather jacket. They are an American treasure made in the USA still. And whenever I see a Shot jacket, I know it's either a rock and roller or a biker or somebody that just enjoys, living outside the box. ShotNYC.com. Check them out. And if you live in Los Angeles, they got a brand new badass store up at the Americana in Glendale. Go up there, see my boy Walter. Fantastic shop, man. And they've got all these great new jackets out now. A lot of Japanese Shot jackets that are fitted and fit like slim and way better. I love them. Everybody asks what one I'm wearing. I'm wearing the 603. So if you're looking for a great slim fit rock and roll jacket, go to ShotNYC.com or the kick-ass news store at the Glendale, next to the Galleria at the Americana. That's that outdoor Glendale mall that looks like the Grove. Thank you, ShotNYC. I love you guys, and I can't wait to... see what else you guys got coming out this year. Today is, I gotta say, I'm at like 136, something, I don't know, episodes, and this is probably one of my favorite conversations I've had in years. Of course, you've heard, I talk a lot about doing drugs back in the day, and I talk a lot about getting high, but it's funny how you forget if you can talk to somebody that is, I consider, genius. My guest today, Duncan Trussell, I consider him, kind of level of genius. You could see how this guy could probably run shit, super spiritual. But what I'm trying to say is you forget a good conversation in this text world and digital world of emails and shit. You forget how great a conversation between two people can be, especially when you're really engaged in what you're talking about, As I'm talking about that, an email comes through. Hilarious. But it's true, man. Sometimes you got to sit down, turn your electronics off, and enjoy the ride. And that's what I did with Duncan. It was fantastic. This guy, I could talk to this guy for hours about anything. We talk spirituality. We talk comedy store talent buying. We talk, he's a cancer survivor. We go all over, man. And that's what a great conversation is. It's a ride, and you walk away and you feel like you... you got some incredible knowledge. I hope you guys enjoy this as much as I did. Duncan is just a fantastic guy. Check out his website, the DuncanTrussell.com and his podcast, Duncan Trussell Family Hour. This guy's great, man. That's all I got to say. Before I get into it, just going to say I had an incredible weekend. Of course, if you listen to the last episode, I was going to host and sing at the NAMM show, Bonzo Bash Jam and Randy Rhoads Remembered. And I got to say, man, it was unbelievable. I want to thank right away Brian Tichy and Joe Sutton who put it on. I don't think people understand the magnitude of these shows. There was over 150 players, 3 days. It was Bonzo Bash, then the next day was Randy Rhoads Remembered, and then the next day was The Ox and the Loon, which is a tribute to The Who. I mean, all the crew, the venue, the people, the press, the friends, the fans, everyone that came to this thing, it was magic, man. And I can't thank Brian Tichy enough for, you know, it felt like a rock and roll, you know, summer camp to me. I was on stage with Rudy Sarzo and Tracy Guns, Brian Tichy, also Ricky Rocket from Poison, Michael Devin. I played with these guys. This is shit when you're a kid. You never think you're going to play with like Rudy Sarzo when you're at Day in the Green watching him play in front of 60,000 people with Randy Rhoads up there doing I Don't Know. You don't think you're going to jam with him, especially when you're 48 years old. Like, you know what, man? When I'm 48, I'm going to rock with those guys. It was fucking insane. I was so, oh, man. And Randy Rhoads, the Zeppelin night was 5 hours, and it was just insanity, you know? When that guy, what's his name? Port, I never know how to say his name. Portnoy, the drummer from Dream Theater. Yeah, and also Winery Dogs, of course. When he got up there and they got into, they did a 3-song jam for Zeppelin, it was insane. Everybody killed. No egos. Everybody just out there. Rowan Robertson, who joined Dio when he was 14, and he's going to be on the podcast soon. He got up there and just murdered the Randy Rhoads stuff. Rowan Robertson, a guy you just haven't heard his name in years. I haven't. Walks on and destroys. Alex Skolnick from Testament, Bay Area friend, crushing. Sebastian Bach, singing like a crazy man. Loved it. Anyway, thank you, Brian. I love you, man. It was insane. Absolutely insane. I guess that's about it. Let's get into the episode. Come see me this Friday and Saturday if you live in Los Angeles. I'll be 4 shows at the Ice House, January 30 and 31. 4 shows. Come out. Let's party. I love you guys. Keep rocking. And light the candles of rock. Here he is, Duncan Trussell. Yeah, here we are. Another episode of Let There Be Talk. Great guest today, Duncan Trussell.
Hi.
I've been trying to get you on for a year.
A year? Well, I don't think it's been quite a year.
Well, yeah.
It's been a year.
Nah, I don't know. You're busy. I get it.
Yeah, but yeah, that's a funny thing, isn't it? That idea of being busy.
Yeah, right?
Like, are you really that busy?
Yeah, it's insane. You're just like, you know what? It's like, it's so stupid if you looked at how much we work on paper compared to someone 8 hours and commuting, but you really are busy. Because you're like, all right, I'll do this podcast tomorrow. And then you go, oh, fuck, I got this meeting. And then I got to go over here. Like right now, you said you're looking for a place to live.
Yeah.
That kind of shit, just life gets in the way.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have a guy over that you forced over to the podcast. And then they're like, oh, I got to get out of here, you know?
Yeah, I just, yeah, when I'm getting people for my podcast, I just, it's like throwing out fishing lines where if, you know, you try to, you know, eventually they'll come, but yeah. You're not sure exactly when because, and they are, you know.
They're like checks in the mail, I say.
Yeah.
You're waiting and waiting, and you have no check, and then you go, fuck, I got an episode Monday. You go, boom, oh, shit, I got a check.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, man, it's cool. And then you just sort of have this nice, natural rhythm where people are there exactly when they're supposed to be, which is kind of a wonderful, it's a cool job, you know?
So you said you're looking for a place right now? That's a fucking job, right?
Yeah, it's a job, but it's cool. You know, I love seeing all the different houses out there. I like seeing like all the different potentialities based on money. It's cool to see what a shit ton of money will get you.
Yeah,
it's cool to see what you sacrifice for, you know, $1,000. Like there's all these gradients based on $1,000 where.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. If you're renting or if you have a mortgage, but I think we just want to rent. It's kind of spooky to buy a house.
Yeah. Well, you know, as much as I think about that, then your pipes burst or your fucking, you know, your roof collapses or anything. And it's just all money.
Yeah. And then getting in debt to the bank.
Yeah. And also at the end of the day, what if you don't 10 years from now, you're dead. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just like all that money and stress and everything. I'd rather just find something that I absolutely love, like this place to rent. And then that's out of my mind for the rest of my life. Well, until I almost had to move a few months ago, and it was a couple episodes I talked about it. But
why did you have to move?
Well, I've been here 10 years, and the owner's daughter, who's I think 19 or 20 now, got pregnant, and they were going to move her into here. Mm. So I was like, oh no. And I moved here, you know, 10 years ago when this neighborhood area was not desired. You know, it wasn't UCB and Fixie Bikes and Amoeba and fucking the Arclight. Yeah. It was crack, some gangbangers,
wow.
Couple hipsters.
Up here, I would never think
not up
that.
Here, but down on the main area.
Right.
You know, like on Franklin.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to be in West Hollywood at the time, you know, like around the Comedy Store and stuff. Out here was just like Silver Lake was hip, but all the adjacent neighborhoods weren't.
Where's his pregnant daughter right now?
Well, they decided to get her a place in Studio City, and it was a godsend because you could see this is perfect for me.
What is your owner like in Al-Qaeda or something? Like, why is he like housing his pregnant daughter? Is he
no
it's just a weird idea. Like, I gotta like ship my pregnant daughter. I gotta let my daughter hatch in here.
No, well, they wanted her close by because you know what I mean, so they could be like help her and stuff,
right?
Like, you know, but then
isn't that weird that you that
it's an adult?
No, that you've got to, like, even though human beings like to imagine that we're not animals,
yeah,
it's just that, like, she needs to hatch somewhere. Like, there's a human who needs to hatch. She has to put her larva
in a place. I don't care how old you are. I never get used to a person makes a person.
Yeah.
I'm never going to grasp that.
Well, I mean, I love following that rabbit hole, though. It's such a fun rabbit hole because so many people are so engaged in this kind of agonizing approach to creation. And then if you look at what the ultimate creation on Earth is, as far as we're concerned, the creation that creates is a human being in the sense that, you know, Tesla came out of a pussy and Einstein came out of a pussy. And so you realize...
You think they're sent from somewhere else? I do.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think so. And I think that when you realize when Albert Einstein was gestating in his mother's womb, or what created Albert Einstein was not pacing around on a floor hour after hour after hour, worried, tense, freaking out. Am I really an artist? Oh shit, I hope I can squeeze some creativity out of me. What created Albert Einstein was Mr. Einstein sprayed hot, white, salty stuff inside of his wife's vagina, and that gestated one of the most brilliant humans that ever existed, and was maybe partially responsible for the atomic bomb. And so if you realize that when Albert Einstein's father was spraying jizz into Miss Einstein, he was also spraying the atomic
bomb. Yeah, the atomic bomb.
He was evaporating people in Hiroshima.
Yeah, you know?
So it's a really potent act, but what's really cool is to imagine that as Einstein is developing, his mom's just going about her life, maybe feeling sick, feeling pregnant, all the things that go along with that, but there was no... let me construct the greatest, one of the most intelligent humans that ever lived.
Yeah.
It was just a...
She has no idea.
No idea.
Could have a crackhead in the next baby.
Yeah.
If it was some kind of science to it, it would be like a horse race, you know, famous like horse race, like Secretary or whatever, where they grab the sperm and start
eugenics.
Trying...
They call that eugenics, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, but... And maybe there would be a science to it. You know, that's a funny thing to think about is like if... Yeah. If that was not considered one of the most atrocious, unethical abominations on Earth, if you can imagine the strange variations of humans that we would have if it wasn't all based on chance,
yeah,
it would be crazy to imagine how tall some people would be or like how super smart some people would be.
Yep.
It's interesting, but...
I believe this, which is really weird. I believe that people that are here for a short amount of time and create a massive amount of thunder are sent from a higher power, whatever you believe, say a Kurt Cobain, a Jim Morrison, or whatever the art is. I think when the art gets completely over into the shit area, some kind of fucking fireball comes out and brings it back, and then he disappears. It's almost like he's supposed to be gone. He's not supposed to be here his whole life, because you'd probably see the tail end out of when he goes bad and he's on a reality show. You know what I mean? But you see this fire of like a Kurt Cobain, and then they're gone, and people go, oh yeah, good music. We got to try to play good music or whatever.
Martin Luther King, Gandhi.
Yep. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
All the greats.
I'm just saying on an art side, but also, yes, on a humanity side or whatever kind of side, an inventing side.
Yeah.
All the guys, you know?
Well, you know, there's what you just described in Hinduism is, it's like they say Vishnu, which represents the present moment. In Hinduism, there's Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And Vishnu, that's the Hindu trinity. And Vishnu, like all these gods, they have these like various incarnations that they take. So Krishna is an incarnation of Vishnu. So when Vishnu, and Krishna has multiple incarnations that Krishna takes. But Vishnu is like the ultimate, like the fountainhead that sort of is one of Vishnu's forms of expression. You get like gods like Krishna. Now this is mythology. I'm not saying it like it's real, but it's a symbolic mythology. It's a cool way to like put a grid over this phenomena that you're talking about. And so when things are out of balance, that's when Vishnu appears and incarnates to set things right. And so many Hindu myths are based on, you know, for example, like there's a story of some psychotic king who meditated a long time and managed to get all these potencies that are called siddhis, is what they call them. And so I don't remember how he got this. God gave him some boon or something, but it was basically, I cannot be killed in the day. I cannot be killed at night. I cannot be killed with a sword. I cannot be killed with steel or wood. So he asked for all these things that essentially, theoretically, would make him immortal.
Right.
I cannot be killed by a man. I cannot be killed by an animal. He got all these things that would theoretically would make you immortal. And he's causing all kinds of trouble because he's this like insane, magical, lunatic, mythological being. So Krishna or Vishnu incarnates as, I can't remember the name of it, this awesome lion god thing.
Yeah, that he forgot to put on the list.
Oh, and he said, I can't be killed on land. I can't be killed in the air. So basically this lion thing takes this man, places him on his lap.
Yeah.
Rips his stomach open with his fingernail because he's half lion, half man. So he's not an animal, not a man. He's a mix. He uses his fingernail so it's not wood or steel. He kills him at dusk in between night and day, and on his lap, and then rips his entrails out. And there's all these deities, and you can get this deity or see images of this lion being ripping the guts out of a man.
Right.
And that represents, of course, the
ending of the god. An immortal wannabe, like an immortal guy, right?
Well, it represents that there's no fucking way you can cover your ass in a universe of change. Right, it represents that no matter how clever you think you are, no matter what's, if you're just snorting stem cells every day and just drinking fresh Iraqi child's blood, whatever it is that your crazy plan is to live forever, to keep things static, the universe will time and time again thwart you just in its very nature, and that's what it means. But so it's cool. What you're talking about is when things get weird, the universe balances things, and sometimes that balance comes as Jimi Hendrix.
I believe that. Or a
Martin Luther King.
What's name that was, the guy that played Bane, or not Bane, but Joker. Heath Ledger, like these extreme amounts. You're talking about, of course, like, humanitarian and, people like that. I'm just talking about in the art world for me, when it seems to get really bad, somebody rises above and then it gives inspiration to other people. Like, I want to be great like Heath Ledger or a Seymour Philip Hoppe, that kind of stuff. And they always seem to be troubled people, and I think the troubles are implanted in their brain to take them out.
Right.
Like
a time bomb.
That's right. Exactly. They're here under a timer, and it's slowly ticking away, and they're here just amount of time to show people, what are you doing?
Well, it's probably like this, when they're like, listen, I'll go back there and try to make things a little better, but I'm not staying a whole fucking lifetime this time.
Yeah, right?
It sucks.
That shit's boring.
Minimum amount of time. I'll go there for the minimum amount of time and do what I need to do. And you better fucking make sure I die in the coolest way possible.
Yep.
On heroin. Passed out.
Looking good.
Looking good.
Leather pants, preferably.
Face covered in Olsen twins vaginal secretions as I dissipate into infinity. Fine. Whatever you want, Heath.
Right, right.
I like that idea. I think that's cool. It's like the notion of the this incarnation being a class and the some form of university, and maybe these Heath Ledgers and Martin Luther Kings and whoever it is that comes and makes the world a little brighter, they're kind of like janitors who get sent here to do cleanup.
Yeah,
they're like
and Dylan probably got dropped off. He's the guy that's like, dude, lifetime down here, really?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like you're saying, what are you doing?
Yeah,
I've been here. I'm 78 or whatever.
Sorry, bitch, you're gonna have to get old.
Yeah, we need one guy to make it through.
You're gonna go all withered up like a grape. You just got to deal with that.
He's just William S. Burroughs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Burroughs shot heroin his entire life, lived longer than you or I will.
Yeah.
You're like,
sure.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
I believe heroin, once you maintain it, preserves guys. Do you think that?
I think so. Burroughs thought that. I think he had a lot of ideas around heroin that it had some kind of vitalizing effect, and that
I believe that because Keith Richards really, he's a pretty fucking healthy man, and he did shoot a lot of dope. I think because it's pretty much natural. It's not like Speed, where it's made in a garage with aluminum foil and batteries and shit. You know what I mean? It's a plant, and if you can maintain it, I think you're pretty good.
Well, I mean, the problem with that analysis is that you'd have to like look at the average lifespan of a heroin addict,
right?
And I'm sure they have that data out there, and you might just be making the mistake of taking these outliers who have shit tons of money and are able to have access to really high level medical care. You know what I mean? Because a lot of
you're right. Because I am talking out my ass because it's a million dudes out here right now in Hollywood on heroin. But I don't know if it's
with just blistered, infected, no teeth. Their arms are just have these oozing holes.
Yeah, those are like street junkies that don't have the money to have clean needles, dental care.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything is heroin. Where the other guys, it was heroin and art. Or writing, or whatever it is,
Yeah, well, then now I think that heroin is kind of an antiquated move. I think people are now more into, like, blasting OxyContin and Dilaudid and stuff. Science is taking care of a lot of those things in a pretty beautiful way, I'd say. If that's the path you want to go down, wouldn't recommend it, because, you know, those drugs, and I do love Dilaudid. Like, I have taken Dilaudid. Yep. One of my favorite memories is, like, getting into my mom, like, after my mom passed away, when someone dies of cancer, they leave behind a treasure trove of narcotics. And I remember, like, chomping some Dilaudid on this island off the coast of Georgia. You know, and you're grieving, so you get to be totally crazy, and you get to forgive yourself for being totally crazy. You can do whatever you want. You're blasted on grief, and so it's, yep, like, this is awesome. But chomped some Dilaudid, not literally, you swallow it, you drink them down, but getting on a four-wheeler, riding on a beach on Dilaudid at night, full moon, waves coming in, and just, oh, God, it was a transcendent, beautiful moment. But the repercussions of it are so unfortunate, because there seems to be some kind of serotogenic effect. It seems to have the same serotonin reduction that, like, taking MDMA and those other. So there's a kind of depressive crash.
That the goes come along. Down, yeah.
Yeah, so what ends up happening with those fucking things is you get into a kind of neurological debt.
Yeah.
You know, and
you're constantly trying to get out of the depression mode.
Yeah.
By taking some more.
Yeah.
And then it's just a fucking vicious cycle.
It's no different than getting one of those retarded payday loans with, like, 70% interest or whatever.
Oh, my God. Those people that do that, man. Yeah. It's so insane. I think that I've always had the fascination of heroin because of all the... I never wanted to use a needle. It wasn't partying to me. I didn't. That was the only reason. I was like, well, that's not partying. You right. got to have syringes. And it's. I don't like needles already.
But that's all. To me, that's a kind of funny thing about it's. It's that idea is really interesting to me. I have, like, when I've had to get medical care, I had Dilaudid, like, injected into me.
Right.
So I know what it feels like. So I guess I have shot up, like, yeah. medically.
Oh, me too. When I had my appendix out.
Then you've shot up.
Yeah. But I'm saying me at the hut, getting ready to go do a set, fix up, and then roll. That's just so weird to me.
Isn't that a funny thing? Because there's a lot of politics that go into the way that we get chemicals into our bloodstream. So if you get chemicals through your blood, into your bloodstream through your lungs, for example.
Yeah.
Pretty okay.
Like, no, like, one's smoking weed, right?
Smoking weed, smoking opium.
Yep.
It's okay. Smoking dimethyltryptamine, whatever it is that you're.
I've smoked
inhaling.
Opium before.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Right.
So smoking through the lungs, it's pretty cool. Getting it through your stomach, universally accepted.
Absolutely.
Universally accepted. But for some reason, putting it directly into your bloodstream yourself.
Yeah.
Is derided as the act of a maniac. Like, if you're eating Oxycontin, for example, you're just letting your stomach inject it into your bloodstream.
Right.
It's like there's a little man.
But it's accepted because it doesn't seem junky.
Well, right. But yeah, exactly. Because it does. There's something about taking life into your own hands that is abhorrent to a lot of people for some reason. They just can't accept the fact that you would be that far on the edge,
right,
that you would do something like that. And all the adjectives that get attached to it are pitiful, late stage, sad.
Yeah.
And those, who knows, it could be true, but I remember when I was smoking marijuana when I was a kid, or when I was taking psychedelics before the internet.
Yep.
It was a fucking taboo, man. Like, it was not considered to be.
Man, how old are you?
I'm 40.
Yeah, I'm 48. I hear what you say.
So when we were doing drugs,
yeah,
back in the day, especially cannabis-based drugs, it was not like it is now. Like, now
not
you're like,
all.
Do you want some marijuana? Oh, sure, I'll take some. Or no, thanks. I don't. What kind is it? Indica, sativa? We didn't know any of that shit.
No,
we were breaking the law. We were doing a Schedule I drug that had no medicinal benefits, that the government brainwashing and propaganda machine had been teaching us since the moment we were born was identical to shooting up, and that's what we thought when we were doing it. It was a dark, awful, horrible, societally rejected thing. So when we were getting high, there was that extra edge to it. There was
yeah.
that added sense of breaking the law. And when you have that feeling, then you might start thinking as a kid, oh, I'm breaking the law here. Let's break the law in other ways.
Right.
So sometimes I wonder, like, I think about a advanced, sophisticated, civilized society with like that was being run by super intelligent, non-frightened people would have as one of its number one prerogatives figuring out ways to increase exponentially the levels of bliss that the population that was existing within that society could feel. You'd want that as one of the main explorations in the universe. Instead of studying, let's see the best ways to lock people up or to evaporate people with high-tech bombs, what ways can we successfully increase the happiness, bliss levels, or insight of our population? And drugs is clearly one of the pathways to do that. But because we live in a scared, frightened thing run by angry old men with tight little assholes that like to fuck toddlers, we don't get that kind of life. So all that rant is to say that I think that I wonder if the taboo is completely removed from seeking out ecstatic states in whatever way that you feel you want to do, if shooting up would still be considered a rotten thing to do.
Right. I think mostly about the shooting up is just growing up, I watched a lot of people shoot up, and it's just like people didn't know what the fuck they're doing. They got like miss marks with the big old fucking like baseball on the side of their arm, or they got all these collapsed veins.
All because it's taboo.
Yeah, right. Because they can't go somewhere and go, give me some clean syringes and show me how it's done right.
Yeah.
So they're learning pre-internet. They're not just getting on YouTube finding out how to shoot dope. It's just the junkie before them that showed them.
That's
you know?
It. Yeah. And it creates like that kind of retarded like that kind of mentality when it comes to drugs is so much more destructive. And so it's just ridiculous. Like you're sending people to, you're basically, you have these like, to follow along that idea that we incarnate here as a class, you have these humans who for whatever reason have decided to spend the majority of their life in a deep, passionate pursuit of states of ecstasy.
Yeah.
And the way that they've decided to do that is at the cost of their physical body. They've made the decision that I'm going to accelerate my plummet into oblivion by heightening my bliss states using a narcotic. Because that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're going to die. I'm going to die. Everyone's going to die. We're all getting sucked into a singularity called death. There's no way around it. And
might as well enjoy the ride.
Maybe if you want to.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? It's not might as well. Like, since we're all going to die, let's destroy ourselves. But it is. There are bliss seekers who the way they're looking for this bliss is using fucking narcotics. And the denial of the West, it seems like, is that we're all pretending that we're going to live forever, that we're not going to die, and that for some reason people who are seeking these bliss states are criminals.
And they're crazy. They want to take their lives.
I think they're kind of a form of saint, and I think that's what William Burroughs was talking about. And
right.
I think that's what Neil Young meant when he said every junkie's like a
setting sun.
And I think that's a very poetic way to point out the kind of strangely illuminated state that a person who's made those hardcore life decisions to dedicate their life to the pursuit of pleasure at all costs, even at the destruction of the self and the loss of all friends and family, as selfish and fucked up as that is, it's still such a powerful, major, incredible, glorious decision where you're putting your middle finger up to all the capitalist paradigms and saying, I will literally give up everything, sit on the side of the street in my own fucking diarrhea so that I can experience these heightened states of pleasure because I'm addicted to it and this is what my life is and I've made that choice. A lot of people say you don't have a choice if you're addicted. Well, I don't know. I don't know for sure. And also, all that being said, don't do fucking heroin.
Yeah.
Because there's – not because the law tells you or because society tells you, but because you're shortchanging yourself, because there's other ways to achieve those bliss states that don't involve – getting addicted to a parasitic chemical. That's the truth. And I think that's a really important, that is the real truth. It's not don't do heroin because it's evil. Don't do heroin because what you're doing is you're getting off the elevator on a few floors underneath one of the greatest parties that has ever happened in the course of human existence, but you can't get to that party shooting up.
Right. I mean, Hunter S. Thompson, I think to me it's all about outlaws. When I was growing up, and also I played music for 25 years, so For me, drugs were completely a way to explore a creative side that my heroes did. And also, it's really a good time. You're young, you're doing drugs, you're writing music, you're playing rock, you're around this carefree community of artists and stuff. But in my mind, I really, I wanted to be Bukowski. I wanted to be Hunter S. Thompson. I wanted to just be a rebel outlaw. But with that, the laws changing over the time, everything, like, say, your first drunk driving you get, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, fuck, did Bukowski get DUIs? You know,
yeah, right.
And you start seeing these things of like, fuck, I guess I'm out, you know, or man, my left arm went numb for 2 hours. Better not do any coke anymore, you know? So I stepped in for a long time, really fierce, and now I'm out, you know? If I'm in Amsterdam, I'll do some mushrooms, cruise around, have some fun. I do want to get high, but now my drug is finding a way to become funny.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is really my addiction now, of like, which feels like it's kind of like drugs. I'm using my mind. I'm creative. When I'm on stage, I'm high. It's pretty weird. I could get into a state of euphoria.
Yes.
When I'm sitting there and you're really doing good. It's so fuck. It's exact sometimes to mushrooms, because I'm like, where am I? And when I step off, I'm like, wow, what, that was another dimension.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ways that drug culture has shortchanged a lot of people, is that they've sort of, people who are like psychonauts or really like on the psychedelic train, especially the most notable being Terrence McKenna, they had some real problems with like people who meditated or people who had taken more spiritual approaches to achieving bliss states, because they couldn't fathom the idea that you could hit those same states minus the chemical. And I think that's a real fucked up thing. And I think that's another problem with the goddamn drug prohibition, is that as part of this shitty reptilian conditioning that a lot of people have gotten, has had inside of it sentences like, get high on life.
Yep.
You can get high on life, but it's coming from the wrong source.
It really is.
So you
It's hear, coming from the police.
Yeah, it's coming from the police. So when you hear that, you think, fuck you, asshole. I'm not going to get fucking high on life. Fuck you. Yeah,
so dumb.
So dumb. So dumb. And I think that level of skepticism, high level of skepticism, if you're somebody who's been taking psychedelics your whole life, when you hear somebody say, listen, man, I'm telling you, that not only can you achieve a state, a psychedelic state, minus putting something into your body, but you can achieve a state a million times more psychedelic than whatever the drug is you're putting in your body, just by some very simple daily practices. There should be a healthy dose of skepticism when you hear that, if you've ever like experienced the merging that can happen on a true psychedelic trip. But God damn it, man, that's not a joke.
It's not.
Not a joke.
I think it has a lot to do with what people really undersell in their life is zero debt, say, the credit card debts and the walls you have created around your life.
Yeah.
And even people in their mid-30s, you know? When I was in my mid-30s, I was fucking around the world or whatever. They've created these compounds of their mind. So my ultimate high is freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom meaning not being in jail, not debt, being in debt, and also not being sick in some way. So the ultimate high is being 48 years old, stepping on a stage at the Comedy Store and absolutely answering to no one.
Yeah.
You know, no bosses, no car credit debt calls, no fucking, ex-wives or things you didn't want that you set up that you thought you were supposed to have growing up.
Yeah, I love that, man. That's really cool. It's really smart. And keep following that. You keep following that. You follow that impulse, right? So it's like, okay, what do I what to me means I'm trapped, right? What does it mean if I'm trapped? So you start with the externals, right? Definitely being in debt is a big trap.
Absolutely.
And then being in prison, of course, the ultimate trap. You're literally in
the worst trap there is.
Right. And then, of course, having a ex-wife or all the things that go along with that is or an ex-husband even is a trap, right? So the idea is keep following that back because you want to find what is the root. What is being in debt, being in prison, having an ex-wife? What do you think all those things have in common in the way that they limit a person?
Yeah.
What do you think they all have in common?
They all have in common. They're all traps, but they're to
me. What's the first thing you need to be trapped?
Somebody saying no. It's somebody else.
No, you need a self.
You
right?
need a self. Your own. You've stepped into the trap.
I'm saying that if. It's an impossibility to trap a thing that isn't there.
That is, or isn't trappable.
Yeah, which would be a thing. So to be trapped,
yeah.
If you want to get your fucking hand stuck in the goddamn bear trap, you got to have a hand,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting when you start going, you start like letting the termites of your mind begin to erode all the way back down. So you're saying, oh, I don't want to be fucking trapped. I don't want to be in debt. I don't want to be stuck in all the different miasmic quicksand pits, all the fucking glue traps that exist in modern society. A lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, God damn it, I'm fucking trapped.
Yeah.
I've got an ex-wife. I don't have comedy. I've got to pay these fucking debts.
Yeah.
I'm in debt. I'm in a fucking rat trap. And here's what's awesome. If you believe that the removal of debt, right, or the getting rid of all the external things in your life that are holding you down is going to make you completely free, then you haven't gotten there all the way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What you're talking about is if you want to be a Buddhist monk,
yep.
and you go to be a Buddhist monk, they will say to you, what is your debt in the world? And you're like, oh, I owe this much money. They'll be like, okay, get out of debt and then come back and we'll sit together in the monastery and we'll meditate. But the idea, what's really beautiful is that even in the midst of being trapped, if you're in prison, if you're in a mental prison or a physical prison, a debt prison, a relationship prison, if you begin to explore the notion of what am I? What am I? What am I? Do I have an essential self? Am I a self? What do I really think I am? Right? You'll quickly start realizing like, shit, man, I'm not really anything.
Yeah.
Try to find yourself in your body. That's one of the first in Buddhism. That's one of the one of the exercises they'll give you right away is like, where are you in your body? Can you find where you are? The you that makes all the decisions, the you that likes things and dislikes things, and it gets hurt and feels bliss. And where is that? Identify it. Find it. It's really fun to do. Just to sit still. Like, where the fuck am I in this house? Where's
right.
the ghost in this house? Find the ghost. Become the ghost hunter team like in those retarded TV shows.
Yeah.
And start exploring your house with every single meter that you can, the house of the self. Locate your identity in there, and guaranteed you're going to come up short because it ain't there. It ain't there, brother. It's not there.
Yeah.
We're a temporary fleeting conglomeration of atoms that are
I get it. We're nothing in the big picture.
Yeah.
But the thing I like to preach a lot is, don't get me wrong, people go, that's easy for you to say, no debt, no everything. I had all those. Mm-hmm. And then once you free yourself from them, if you don't take that freedom and do what you really wanted to do, and you get right back to where you were again, you're just a fucking moron.
Yeah.
I learned my lesson in my first 35 fucking years, and then went, you know what? Okay, I've had this tick in my mind. You should be doing comedy.
Yeah.
And it's ticked since fucking I was 9. I saw Belushi on Saturday Night Live or Bill Murray, you know, and then Animal House and Caddyshack and then the fucking Pryor Records and everything. And me at the locker in 7th grade telling a story and the guys are laughing. There was something to that that always sat in the back of my mind like a fucking plant. And it never went away. The dream didn't die. What happened was the dream got clouded by all kinds of bullshit evil of debt and fucking drugs,
yeah,
and whatever else I was polluting it with. And not to sound like fucking a weirdo or whatever, but once that was gone, I saw the door open, and I was like, I'm going.
Mm, yeah, that's beautiful, man. It's exciting for people to realize that
it really is.
That there is that you know, because again, you know, you construct reasons to not. If you really like look at your life, you quite often you'll find that wherever you happen to be, I mean, even if you're in like, I'm trying to think of like the worst situation. Let's say you're in prison, like in Locked Up Raw.
That is the worst, don't you think?
Well,
do you think there is worse than prison? How about terminally ill outside of prison? Which one would you take?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to go for prison.
Is that right?
Yeah, man. Because you know, it's like yeah, I think I'll go for prison. I think that there's a very. I've just been like, if you spend some time every day, man, just sitting still, watching your breath go in and out of your nose.
Meditating or just do nothing? Just sitting there?
Sit still, watch the breath go in and out of your nose, and just start watching your thought patterns. And then start watching the fluctuations in your emotional state. You know, like, just sit still, follow the breath in and out of your nose. Watch when you're not watching the breath go in and out of your nose. You realize, like, what starts happening if you start doing this every day. You'll start realizing, like, whoa, there are, like, I'll have, like, one thought, whatever it may be, about the girl, about the job, about the family, whatever it is. And that thought will drag me as though I was fishing and a fish is dragging my fishing boat through my mind.
Right.
And you'll be gone. Like, you'll literally be gone for a certain amount of time as you're sitting there breathing. You won't even realize that you're gone, but you'll be like, oh, this and this and that, and this shit today, and then that, and then. And then all of a sudden, you'll be like, oh, wait, I'm watching my breath, I'm watching my breath. And then you go back to watching your breath. And you start finding out in that kind of very simple practice that you are spending a lot of your waking time not existing at all. You're not even here because instead of being here, you're up in your head contemplating, or you're lost in emotion.
You think it's a brain thing? It's just like your brain is so fucking, like, just crazed. I mean, a lot of people just say it's really hard to meditate and go somewhere and everything with so much shit in the food and in the air and in the fucking water or whatever.
Yeah.
Your brain could never really just fucking zoom down to, say, a brain from the 30s. When there's not much going on out this window.
A brain from the 30s. Yeah. Here's what's so funny, man. Here's the funny thing, man. You know, Buddhism happened thousands of years ago. Yeah. And even back then, people's minds were as wild as they are now. Only the difference is the symbols inside the mind were more, were what we would consider...
tame.
Not tame at all. People were regularly getting eaten by tigers back then.
So, right. You know, yeah. But what I'm saying is, when we have so much info coming in, like if we just look out the window right here, you see the freeway, you see trees, I see the ocean. That's the ocean straight out there. You can see it. And then you start thinking, then you look around in my place, it's full of shit. I got the computer there. It's like, Now, back then, you're just in a jungle. Your brain is completely empty. Only thing it's probably really thinking about is surviving, eating food, and fucking staying warm or cool.
I'll tell you,
water.
Here's one interesting, when you start watching your thought patterns, one interesting thing that you'll find that there seems to be a tendency in your thoughts. The moment you decide to start entertaining the notion that they don't have to be the most powerful aspect of your existence, they will start throwing up some really great reasons for why they are, or more importantly, why you're trapped within them.
Yeah.
So they'll say, ah, the fucking water, the modern society. Listen, man, everybody's fucking snow globe is going to be permanently shook up. There's no way to settle these little fucking flakes in it. Trust me, don't even try.
Right.
That's one of the things that it does.
They're trying to steer you from complete bliss, like mind and power. Right.
Yeah.
Like if everybody was chill and had like they would just really wake up to the evils of government and stuff is what you're saying. Right. And be like, fuck, you are out of here.
Well, what I'm saying is that the government and all the external stuff that's raging in the world, that's been compared to a fire. So the modern life or archaic life is the same fire. And the fire that's always raging is basically the tendency of the human consciousness to get trapped by attraction and aversion. So there's things we like and there's things that we don't like, and most people spend much of their day running towards what they like or running away from what they don't like, or that's the game of football that that's the field we're running on. So to get back to the prison idea of being trapped or ultimate freedom, ultimate freedom, in my mind, is what's called the unconditioned state, which means that I am no longer running away from life or towards life, but I'm just right here in this moment right now with a full understanding that the feeling conditions and the thought conditions in my mind are just like weather patterns that come and go. And if you start playing around with that, then God damn it, man, you start getting these weird little moments of what's called expansiveness,
right?
Which is where it's like, oh shit. You know, just for that one fucking second, I didn't react to the thought that I was having that I should scream at that person.
So I get what you're saying. You're saying no matter where you're at, if it's prison or, fucking eternal sickness or whatever, eventually you can get to somewhere in your mind of happiness.
It's like the question is, where would you like to sleep? Where would you like to be in the deepest, deepest sleep of your life? Would you like to be asleep in prison? Would you like to be asleep in a soft bed in the Taj Mahal? Would you like to be asleep on Mars? The answer is, I don't give a fuck,
because
I'm not there.
Right, you're sleeping.
So, yeah, exactly. And so that's the idea. The point is it's like, if you haven't managed to feel, and a lot of people haven't felt in a long time, man, like literally,
yeah,
like right now, if you want to do a really fun exercise, anybody listening or you can just, I know this sounds fucking crazy, feel your feet in your shoes.
Yeah,
just feel your feet in your shoes. Just do that and you'll be like, oh yeah, I'm wearing shoes. Oh shit, I haven't felt that in a long time.
Right,
the bane of all toddlers. You know what I mean? Like a kid, what's the first thing a kid does when they get in a house? They rip their fucking shoes off like there's rabid weasels tied to their fucking feet.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel good.
Right.
We don't like it. We're imprisoned by that. You know, it feels like shit. But we learn to ignore that. Oh, just fucking ignore that pain. Right. And then if you take it up a little bit up into your legs and you start feeling your legs again and you feel your body, start feeling your stomach and your back and your face, and then you're like, whoa, man, my legs, I can feel my, or like if you're in a chair, for example, feel how the chair is supporting you. Just that alone, just feel the way that your body just sinks into the chair and you're managing to effortlessly hold your body up, and you can just feel where your ass is touching the chair, your arms are touching the chair, and all of a sudden there's all these new sensations that you'll start experiencing that you haven't felt maybe for a long time if you've been lost in the tornado vortex of your thought patterns. And that is the that's why a lot of people say, you know, one day of being awake is better than an complete poverty is better than an entire lifetime of being dead asleep and having $1 billion. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, you don't even know that.
Because you don't even know it.
It's interesting. Like, sometimes I was talking to Pete Holmes about this. I work so fucking hard. I'm completely afraid not to work. Like, for instance, my favorite place on earth is this place called Rancho Pescadero. It's in Todos Santos. It's at the bottom of the Baja.
Wow.
It's like 4 miles of beach, no one, yeah, absolute no one.
Yes.
It's like Planet of the Apes when they land and they see the rocket.
Yeah.
When I'm there, and I've gone twice in my comedy career of 5 years, I'm going on the 6 years, it scares me to death because I'm like, this is too good.
Yes.
I got to get the fuck, my shoes are off. I know, I'm eating some fresh fruit. Mm. My feet are in the sand,
yeah,
and I'm completely alive.
Yeah, that's it.
And I'm so into it that I'm like, I got to get the fuck out of here, mm-hmm, because this is too good.
That's it, man. You know? There you go.
So I understand what you're saying. I've numbed all the madness, but I do enjoy the stage of comedy. But everything else I've numbed. And I know it because when I step off the plane and I'm at Todo Santos, I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
I think it could add like 15 years to your life just living there.
Well, here's the glorious fucking idea, man, is that feeling of like, whoa, that you're getting at Todo Santos, or that I get when I go to Maui, or that feeling of like, whoa, that feeling is enlightenment. And the idea is that you can have that feeling wherever you happen to be, because you're made of the same material that Todo Santos is made out of. You're made of the same material that the ocean lapping against the beach. You're made of that, and that's what you are. You are non-different from that. You will go back to being that again. And when you start realizing that, then that you're carrying the primeval or the primordial glory of the deep natural world, that when you get into like deep in the forest, or when you get like far out in nature, you just have that sense of that overwhelming rushing joy, that like exhilarating feeling of like, oh my God, yeah, no one around, so much space. That is what you really are. And the process of meditation or any other great discipline, including comedy, it hopefully starts breaking down your sense of self, or hopefully it will start helping you take the very tight, uncomfortable shoe of symbols that you've tied around the foot of your soul.
Yeah. I get it. I mean, that's what I'm saying. When I step on the stage, it is Todo Santos.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I was born in Yosemite and lived there the first part of my life. I spent so much time there that once I was around 21, I didn't go for 15 years. I'd done that, you know what I mean? And I think about maybe 7 years ago, I rode my motorcycle up there. And as I rode into the valley, I stopped. And it was like when you come through the tunnel, you see Half Dome on the right. You see the valley. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, man, this is like, I could hear nothing except like a welcome back. It felt like that, like, we got you back, you know? And now when I go there, it's like, oh my God, man. And it's funny to be from that ground zero and then grow up in the Bay Area and then be in Hollywood and rock and roll all your life. Yeah. It's all noise.
Yeah.
Gah! Yeah. And then you get there and it's like, shh, you know?
I know, man. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, I know.
So you find that stuff. What's great what you're saying, and what I believe is, when you truly are doing what you love in life, I don't give a fuck what it is, mechanical drawing, a tractor guy, or, you know, a farmer, what if you're truly doing what you love, that's the sound you hear. It's just
that's it, man. That's what you just said is it. And here's the thing. It's not doing what you love. It's realizing that you are love. And that's an important differentiation, because, again, like your whole life you'll hear, especially as a kid, do what you love. Yeah. And you're always like searching around like a fucking squirrel foraging for nuts. Like, let me find what I love. I don't know if I really love this or that, or I don't really know. Because a lot of the things that we find ourselves doing, even the things that we should love, every once in a while it feels kind of false, meaningless, and empty. So it's like the idea is in the process – of trying to do what you love.
It's amazing you say that. And I don't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to do comedy as a young child, but it was adults doing it. I didn't really know how to do it. I loved music.
Yeah.
I love music right now more than a woman I've ever had.
Yeah.
The way it makes me feel. But what I realized when I started doing comedy 5 years ago was I slipped into music, played it 25 years. But I don't think I really loved playing music as much as I loved music.
Right.
And I really realized that when I started doing comedy, I was like, I fucking love this.
Yeah.
I loved music. Don't get me wrong. I played it and did it for 25 years, yeah. And I was a lucky human. Like, I don't work at Burger King. You know what I mean? I'm fucking playing music. And because of music, I met all the greatest people, and they're my friends now. And I really believe it was the long road to get to comedy. Without the music thread, I wouldn't have the knowledge and the friends and even the people that have sat on this couch to do my podcast without music.
Yeah.
But did I love doing it? No. And I think I was fooling myself the whole time because there's just too much mechanics of it compared to, like, say, when you have four guys and it naturally happens. Yeah. It never felt like it was naturally happening.
Yes.
I always had to fight for shit. Ah, this guy, that guy, me, that. You know.
Yeah.
With comedy, I don't fight nothing. I go on and it just kind of channels through me. Mm. A joke comes out of nowhere and I'm like, wow, that just came out. I don't know where the fuck that came from, but boom.
Yeah, that's a great question. Where did it come from?
I know, right? I believe that that your mind, when it's completely open, it's a lot of times like what I say. People go, oh, do you ever go on stage with notes? Never. And they go, well, why not? What if you forget? And I go, that's the genius. What if you do forget?
Yeah.
Where's that part of your mind going to take you? It's going to take you to something. And I'll tell you in my set where it was naturally took me. And I got bits from, I don't know where I'm at. And I threw something out and the recorder was on and I have this gold nugget now. It's the same as mining for
gold. How hard did you try to get that gold nugget to come out of the nothingness into the somethingness?
All the time when you sit down. And I believe everybody has.
But when you're on stage.
Yeah.
And that moment you just described where it's like, whoa, shit, what was that? How did that come out of me? How hard did you try for that?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
In the same way that, like, your landlord's daughter isn't trying to gestate her baby or Einstein's mom isn't trying to gestate her baby. It's effortless. And why is it popping out of you? Well, I would bet that the reason these things are popping out of you when you're on stage is because you're fully present.
Absolutely.
You're
so right.
Yeah. And that state, you know, I was at the UFC
making out with Ari on TV. I love it.
Ari on TV.
Dope. Could be the coolest thing ever because I hate homophobia and I hate racism.
Me too.
So I love that you did that because in the middle of this, they're like two guys kissing.
Yeah. And the timing worked out perfectly where the guy's like ass got in front of us at just the right time.
It was so awesome.
Yeah, it was really
cool. How did you do that? Could you see where the cameras were?
Yeah. Well, we had been sort of like, we had been flashing Illuminati signs.
I saw that.
Before that.
Which is great.
So, and then like, then we were like, oh shit, you know what, man, we're going to have to do like a kiss cam moment after we do these Illuminati signs so that we, you know, I think people like to create stereotypical sports fan. Like maybe
that's correct.
They like to imagine that for the UFC out there, there's some kind
of, those guys just kiss, kill them.
But weirdly, when you like are around people who are into that kind of fighting and when you're around people like martial artists, they've like, usually their egos are like quite often, they just don't really, that kind of shit doesn't really freak them out at all.
Well, they're also coming from kind of martial arts, which I really love, which is different than football. Football's like, jocks, frat, and all that.
Yeah.
Martial arts is it's a whole thing of spiritual mind, body, and hurt the opponent for this, but it's for, you know, it's for like protection in the old world, you know what I'm saying, like a Bruce Lee world.
Yeah, and usually people who have a spiritual discipline are quite often, if it's real, they're usually pretty funny.
Yeah.
And so shit like that is like funny to them. Like they recognize the ridiculousness of two guys suddenly deciding to, without talking, like it's so dumb, that video, because it's like we're not even in, we're watching and then suddenly like telepathically we decide to just kiss just because we've been studying. It's
so
good.
Let's set it up a little bit. So last week you guys are at the UFC, Rogan does a show, so you and Ari open for Rogan.
Me and Ari and Diaz open for Rogan. Rogan is
the MC.
Rogan like is the host of the UFC, and so he the next night's the UFC, and he like is lets us sit ringside, which is just already awesome. The most awesome.
It's already just unbelievable.
What the fuck?
When you're that close to two men beating each other, it's pretty weird, because you're like, have you ever been at a bar and two guys start fighting?
No.
Well, I've seen a couple like hairy brawls.
Yeah.
And when you're that close, you're like, that's some serious fucking man-to-man combat there. You know?
When you watch the up close, the shockwaves of a punch rolling through someone's head.
Totally.
And you can see that happening.
It's pretty brutal.
Even the small, on TV a lot, before I ever got to watch it up close, when I would watch it on TV, you see these little small punches. You know, like maybe you'll see a leg kick.
All of them would fuck us up.
Forget it.
You'd
be in the hospital.
Totally.
You'd be done. Like, if any of these guys kicked you in the leg once, as hard as they're kicking each other in the legs hundreds of times, you'd be finished. But, so, we get to sit ringside, and we basically timed it out perfectly so that we kiss during a fight. I think it was the Tavares. I don't remember which fight, but we kissed during a fight. And then, of course, people started uploading pictures of us kissing.
Yeah,
they know we're comedians, though, so it's like, it totally worked out. But to get back to what I was saying before that, we were eating the night before the fight, and one of the fighters came, and John Jones came, and started talking to Rogan. And, you know, this guy's got the biggest fucking fight of his life the next day. And he is so calm and collected and so in the moment. I don't get that. He's got to fight. He's got to fight in front of millions of people to keep his title. He's been training for it for God knows how long. Like, I'm more nervous about going on stage this week. But he's so calm, so disciplined, you know? So in the moment, and I was talking to my friend Aubrey about it, and Aubrey's like, he's going to win tomorrow. Because if you look at, like, he's like, you can often tell. He was saying, I wish I could bet watching the fighters walk up. Because you can tell the ones who are in the moment.
Right.
And he said, this is what Aubrey said, that's really stuck with me. He said, you're fastest in the moment. You're fastest in the moment. You're fastest in the present moment. That instinctual, spontaneous, weird, effortless creation of the greatest thing ever, whether it's a physical movement or whether it's a verbal something that you're saying, it's still, if you're in the present moment, whatever's coming out of you tends to be incredible. But the moment, you know, like when you're on a date and you find yourself thinking about what you're gonna say
while the
girl's talking to you,
you're not
listening. You're not there.
You
know? And if you're on stage, it's a million times worse.
So you're so correct, though, because there's so many times where you're just like, wow, I'm in the moment here. I can't believe how magical that set went by. Like, at your store, and the fucking light comes on, the 15-minute light, and you're like, wow, already? You know what I mean? You were just completely in a fucking another world.
Well, you were gone.
Yeah, you were gone.
And that's, okay, so that right there, that thing there, you were gone. A lot of comedians will say that. I wasn't there. I don't know who that was. I don't know what that was. I wasn't there. Really, it wasn't that you weren't there. It's that when you're not on stage, you're not there. And when you're on stage, you become what you really are, which is a thing that transcends identity. And that can only happen in the present moment, which is why from, you know, martial arts to meditation practices, they all kind of revolve around this idea of as much as you can be in the present moment, or one of the great spiritual books of all time, Be Here Now. Be here now. Just be right here.
Yeah.
Don't worry about,
You're right.
Don't worry so much about your goddamn debt and your wife, or ex-wife, or wife that you have, or your job, whatever it is. Worry about that after you figure out how to be in the moment for the first time, maybe in a long time. Yeah. Then start worrying about your fucking the fact that you're in prison, or the fact that your liver is turning into goddamn pate, or whatever the fuck is happening to you. Worry about that shit later, because right now all you got to do is worry about, like, just for a second, be like you were when you're a fucking kid, which is just you're fucking here.
Yeah. It's true, right?
And it's a cool place to be, man, because it's a low population density in the present moment. Most of the human population is existing in their heads. And so whenever you find yourself, like, hanging out in the present moment, you realize, like, shit, man, it appears that there are not a lot of people here right now.
Yeah, yeah. How long you been doing comedy?
God, you know, that's I think like 14 years.
14 years.
13 years, maybe. I don't know the exact amount. I'd have to – and it's a funny thing because – many of those years were spent loosely doing it, you know?
And yeah, just part-time in it.
Yeah, part-time in it. So I don't really
in
know.
In another state or L.A.?
L.A.
Right.
Yeah, I started.
You don't start till here.
I started at the Comedy Store. I started working at the Comedy Store, didn't want to do comedy, thought it'd be a cool place to work.
Just like a manager or something?
I was the talent coordinator.
I remember that, but how did you start, though?
I started on the phones.
Yeah.
So I was answering phones. I remember the first time I talked to Mitzi, she's like, are you a comedian? And I'm like, I don't think so. I don't know. And she's like, well, you never know, honey.
Right?
It was so funny.
No one knows, right?
Yeah. But I didn't really have the confidence to think that I would be a comedian back then, and it was a really slow, gradual process for me.
And what gets you on? Just you're there all the time, so you say, fuck it, I'm gonna try it.
You've got these like precious spots that you get from being an employee, the employee spots, which are precious because it's hard to get up at the store.
Yep.
And a lot of comedians want to get up at the store, so you're around comedians, and then they start compelling you to do it, and so there's this awesome, that's why it's like kind of a school. And then you do it and you get the hook in your mouth. He's like, that was the greatest feeling I ever had in my fucking life. And then you're drawn to do it again and again and again. And then sometimes you're like, that's the worst feeling I ever had in my fucking life.
Yeah, right? let me ask you, because you've done it, and it's the world of, and I often tell people this a lot, if you put all your chips on one table and that table burns down, you have no more chips. Meaning, if you are only a Comedy Store guy, or only a Laugh Factory guy, or only an improv guy, and that talent buyer goes away, and the new talent booker comes in, you might be out. Yeah. I've seen it many times at the Hollywood Improv. Since I've been doing comedy in 5 years, I've seen three bookers there already. Comedy Store, of course, the entire time I was there, it was Tommy, and it's been basically Jamie at the Factory. But what kind of pressure was that, man? Because it's got to be... We're seeing it like Adam's doing it now.
Oh, being the talent coordinator?
Yeah.
No pressure, because I work for Mitzi and she was doing all the lineups.
Well, you had that loop,
and
right?
And it was real.
You'd be like, yeah, okay. So you could go, that's Mitzi, not me.
I had no power. Like, okay. The idea that, like, I was her assistant. Like,
right.
There was no, like, deciding who goes up and who doesn't go up. There was just, like, you would go through. It was, like, truly, you know, like doing the podcast, I've met a lot of people with like varying degrees of like personal power, that weird shit that they emanate.
Right. Yep.
But man, that woman is a fucking volcano of power. And she's like, it's like talking to fucking Napoleon or something, you know, or you feel like you're talking to like, you know, she's a very potent person. So, you know, once or twice a week, we would have to go through the avails sheet, you know, and it's this old school way of getting avails. I don't know if they still do it, but you have all the comics' names. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
On paper,
Saturday.
You call in, they mark them.
Okay, and so then you have to go through the list with her and read the names, right?
So she goes like, Tuesday,
so
what do you
say,
got?
You'd say Argus Hamilton, 9:15.
Right.
Then you'd say like, I don't know, I'm not going to say a comic's name, but when I got the job from Corey Como,
uh-huh.
who was married to Freddie Soto, who passed away. Freddie Soto and Corey didn't want to do that fucking job anymore. And they called me up one night and said to me, do you want this job? And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. That was exciting. And both of them said to me adamantly, they said, Duncan, your job is to keep people in the business, not to put people out. You don't need to be the person who talks shit to Mitzi about people or tells Mitzi that people aren't funny or that you think they're not funny or whatever. Your job is to keep them here. Mitzi will do a good enough job pushing them out if they're supposed to be out. So don't fuck anybody.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's what they said to me. And so that was always my motto when I was doing that fucking job. So you would get to
So if personally, even if you didn't like a comedian, you're not going to go like, you know, that guy bombs
so
all
you,
the time.
You get a call from a comedian who wasn't getting the spots they wanted,
yeah.
Right? I won't say any names.
So you don't need to say names.
A comedian, and they would say to you, old school comic maybe, he's not getting the spots they want. And they would say to you, Duncan, I can't remember this one specific call, where this comic says, Duncan, I want you to call Mitzi and tell her that I think she's a fucking cunt and that I'm never going to be at that club again.
He's already not at that club.
Well, no, he's getting spots.
I know, but they're not the ones he wants.
But you know he's angry.
Yeah.
That's an angry comic. Yep. And comics are ridiculous, dramatic beings. So you know in that moment, he's not in his right mind.
Right.
So you say to him, like, I remember he said, read that back to me. So I read it back to him. And, and he's like, you're going to call her? I'm like, yeah, I'll call her. Don't throw it away.
Yeah.
I'm not going to fucking ruin your goddamn your spots at the store.
You're having a bad day.
Yeah.
You're going to shoot your career down because you didn't get something else. And you're like, who can I harpoon on this?
Or Mitzi would like point out like some like young up and comer. Right. And for whatever reason at that particular time, because some backstabbing shitbag comic had said something nasty about that person because they wanted him gone, she'd be like, fuck that asshole. I don't trust that. Yeah, and then you'd be like, no, he's, you know what, I saw him, he's funny, he's the other night I saw him, he's okay. So you're always in this, like, my tightrope walk was one of doing as much damage control as I could, and not to try to make myself seem like some kind of fireman or something like that. It was just like the...
You know the evils of the business. I get what you're saying. Everybody has a problem with somebody or whatever, and it's just the nature, right? So you're just putting out these fires. It's like, that guy doesn't like this guy.
Yeah.
That guy, this guy thinks he's funnier than that guy or whatever, and you're just like, it's just the...
You're just trying to keep Mitzi from banning people.
Right,
that's
right.
Your job.
I get it.
If you can keep people in the... You're trying to keep as many people in the playground as possible, and that was it for me, and that was what I did. I had no control of the lineups. There was... I can maybe think of like one time or two times when I did, when she was starting to get more sick where I would have done the lineups. But in general, man, it was just like you go through this sheet, you put the names down, and that's it. So there it was to create like animosity with, like, it was hard for comedians to be really angry at me if they weren't getting spots because I think they knew that I wasn't
doing them. Yeah.
Whereas like Adam, Tommy, they got in some really precarious... That's a very precarious situation to get into because you're having to be the arbiter. You're having to be the tastemaker. And with comedy, which is such a subjective thing, what are you going to base that on? Well, you're either going to base it on credits or instinct, right? Either way, you lose. If you base it on credits, you're going to seem like some kind of like, oh, you only put people on TV up. Yeah, those are always the funniest people.
Right.
Only the people on TV. You're kind of fucked there, right?
Yep.
But if you put people up based on your instincts, that means rejecting people based on your instincts too. So as you're sitting and watching some comic who maybe is doing great, you might think to yourself, you know what? I don't like this kind of comedy. I don't think it works with the shows that I'm putting on, so I'm not going to put them up as much. Now you're fucked.
Right. Because
people are like, why aren't you putting up that guy? He's fucking hilarious. So it's a no-win situation.
It really is.
It's a brutal job.
There's no glory in it.
No, there's no glory. There's And also you have some of the most manipulative, charismatic people on the planet actively trying to lube you up to get more spots from.
Yeah.
Man, it was so funny becoming talent coordinator because before I was talent coordinator, I was just the runner and I would just drive Mitzi around in a van. And the fucking... the way comics went from like being as an up-and-coming, unknown comic... not that I'm a known comic now, but maybe a slight bit more. But as an up-and-coming, just literally a nothing. Some comics are real, real snobby shits, man. And, ooh, like, they're actual shitty, fucked up snobs. And I remember they would like be so weird with me. Like they'd treat people like if they thought that you didn't have anything to offer them, or they thought that they were somehow further up the totem pole than you, they were such cunts. And then I remember we become talent coordinator, and goddamn, man, you got a lot of new best friends, man.
Lunches. Passes to concerts.
Insanity.
Fucking insanity. You know, hey, whatever you need. My uncle owns this place.
But I never, when that happened, I did not hold that against them any more than or at least as much as I held against them being weird to me just because I was like a new comic, because I know why.
Yeah.
The reason they're acting like that is because it's everything to them. It is their life. It's their source of happiness. It's their canvas to paint on. You ever see Escape from Alcatraz?
Absolutely, a million times.
Remember
Frank
when
Morris.
They took his fucking painting away from him?
Yeah, and then he kills the
He cuts his fingers off with an axe in the fucking workshop. Remember
right. He's like, "Hey, belly, boom!"
They took away his canvas.
Yeah.
So it's like to have to be in the position where you have to take the canvas away from people because there's only a certain number of canvases to be painted on in any given night. Oh, that's a rough job.
I think it really is, because I think one of the things, and I never did comedy for money, and I still don't now because there's no money, but when you make the transition from your day job, okay, I'm not going to work the day job anymore, I'm starting to work on a regular basis at a certain club, whatever club it is, now it feels to me like I'm an employee of the club. You know what I mean? But it's not a regular job, because you're like, wait a minute. You understand I eat from these checks.
Yeah.
You understand that, right?
Yeah.
Or I pay my rent now that I've made that transition into that. And it's always that weird thing of, if someone new comes along or leaves or whatever, fuck, man, you could be completely out if you just put all your chips into one place.
Well, you know, man, I think that like the even though it's almost what you just said is one of the many like frightening things that the mind will produce, which is it's basically the version of the universe that that version of the universe is a feast or famine universe where there's not enough for everybody, and on paper. Theoretically, it is like that, but as a comedian, artist, or a human being, if you let your mind get caught too much into that trap, then you'll end up, I consider it, because whenever I start bean counting, where I start thinking about, shit, man, if this goes away, or that goes away, or this stops working, that stops working, I don't know what's going to happen, I'm fucked, man.
Right.
So whenever my mind's doing that kind of bean counting, then I know what I'm doing is I've forgotten that one essential truth, which is that if I'm in the present moment, great things come through me effortlessly.
Yeah.
If I'm not here, then
that's beautiful. You're right.
I fuck up.
You're actually waking me up to exactly what you're saying is exactly what I always need to remind myself. Money or no money, I'm doing this.
Well, because that's the, you know, that's the, you got to ask yourself, what's the real paycheck here?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I take, you know, take the richest man on earth, or just take someone like Bill Gates or something, right?
Yep.
Guess what Bill Gates can't buy? The experience of standing in front of a group of strangers on a good night and watching them, tuning into their frequency and having this beautiful back and forth conversation with them that's based on the metronome of laughter. He can't buy that.
Yep.
He can't simulate it. He can't buy it. He can't feel it. He will, no matter how much money that guy has, now he can work at it,
and
maybe get good at it, but there's no amount of money that's going to pay for that feeling that comes when you realize that you are actually learning how to do comedy.
Yep.
That you're actually, this craft is, or whatever you want to call it, is building inside of you. God damn it, I said craft. You know,
no, it doesn't matter though.
Nothing infuriates me more than the fucking, when comedians start talking about their fucking craft to the point where I have a goddamn, on my podcast, I do a thing called The Craftsman, where me and Johnny Pemberton and Brendan Walsh like make fun of that. So forgive me for saying that, you guys.
I love Johnny.
My point is, the paycheck in life is not a fucking paycheck.
Yeah. Well, you know, that goes back to what I'm saying is, I have no fear of not getting the money at all. I use the money as a just a a point. The fear is not being able to get on stage.
Right.
I have no fear of the money because I, dude, sometimes I detail cars in the fucking 109 degree sun, you know, to keep pounding on. Or I do the eBay for people or whatever. I'm constantly working. It's never about the money. If it was, I would have fucking stopped doing art when I was 20.
No, man, you clearly are like completely in love with it. And I think that the way comedy tends to work is that she's like very loyal to people who love her and really love her for the right reasons, you know, and maybe not, maybe. And also the other, that's a sappy schlocky thing to say, but
it's true.
The other thing is that when the cycle of it is based on rejection, you know, it's an art that is taught via rejection. The audience rejects certain aspects of your material or your stage persona or whatever. And you have to either be courageous enough to overcome wanting them to like you because you know that's how you're like, or you have to be able to diminish your ego to the point where you recognize that you're attached to what you think is the right way to be, when maybe it's not. And that's how you refine jokes, and that's part of the process. But in the same way, man, it's like if you convert the concept of whatever your particular profession is that you are pursuing from being one of like a battlefield where you're avoiding mines and just trying to gallop towards victory to more of a kind of beautiful, incredible, super high tech class that you have been enrolled in by some mysterious being or beings or universe that you really will never understand, at least at this point, because you're not getting that kind of information. But if you recognize that, oh no, this is a class, you've been enrolled in the class of having the incarnation of a comedian. So here are the lessons. And the lessons are going to be eating fucking shitty Korean goddamn food because you have $8 in the bank. You don't know. That's going to be one of the lessons. Roaches crawling on your face. Creditors calling you night and day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's going to be maybe one of the lessons. Not
all the hurdles.
Your parents thinking you've gone nuts. You're going to go through this like burning off process where it's like if you're not meant to be in this class, you won't be in the class.
Nope.
You know, like I can remember like when I was in Echo Park I was handling Rogan's MySpace account, doing stand-up comedy, trying to get better at stand-up comedy. The apartment that I was living in had roaches. And I can remember like coming to this apartment, this shitty fucking roach motel, where one of my neighbors underneath me literally would just decided to expand their apartment into the hallway.
Yeah.
So it was like this like family where you would just, as you're going up the stairs, you'd look over and in the hallway was a baby crib and a couch.
They're just a part of the three bedroom now.
They're like, no one's using the space. Yeah. Let's fucking use
hilarious.
The hall.
So two bedroom plus hall.
Yeah, plus hall. So you see that shit. And like, I would go up to my apartment. And I didn't have air conditioning, couldn't afford it. So it was the middle of summer and so hot. And I'd be sitting there, you know, trying to write or pretend that I was writing and watching sweat drip down into my keyboard with roaches crawling on my hands. And I can remember just thinking like, okay, man, I've got $60 in the bank. You know what I mean? I think I can make this last for a week. I think I can get enough food and I'll make this last for a week. Maybe.
Yep.
Maybe. You're getting boxed noodles and shit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Top ramen.
Top ramen. I remember coming home, my landlord.
Five for a dollar.
Yes. Five for a dollar.
I know it.
Ramen tricks.
Yep.
Still somehow managing to drink though. But I remember coming home once and my landlord saying to me, "You're in trouble." And I'm like, why? And she's like, hands me the slip.
Oh.
Car is about to get repossessed. Oh. Car is about to get repossessed because I couldn't afford the payments, man. I'm like late on payments, borrowing money from my fucking folks. But that, I think, is part of the class. And after like maybe like, shit, man, probably like after like 6 years, I fix my credit finally, and like, but it took a long time. Like, so it's like you definitely have to do this.
You do.
You have to climb through the muck a little bit.
You do. I get it, man. Well, like I said, at the end of the day, all I care about is being able to get on. I don't care what comes when I get off.
Yeah.
I don't care if there's an agent, a check, a manager, a BJ, some drugs. I don't care. It's just about getting on and being able to do this.
And then recognizing also how like lucky it is to have a thing that you love that much. Because so many people don't really get that. And if you're in a phase of comedy where you feel that pull in a real way with all your being, if you feel that, man, that's a very beautiful
it is
part of your life to be in, and a very rare thing. Just that, man, that's way better than anything else.
I don't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't care about anything else. Like, I'm slowly selling anything in my house. My dream is just a couple couches to do the podcast, my turntable records, and just clear mind. You know, they say cluttered house, cluttered mind.
That's
and I
true.
Believe that this stuff is all slowly going away. And this view and my stage at night is all I need.
It's a beautiful thing that you're talking about, man. It really is. And that is all, that truly is all you need. I mean, that really is it. All the other shit, you know, all this other stuff, man, is pretty exciting. But it's like nothing can really approximate.
Just weighs you down.
It distracts you.
Yeah. I think it comes also from like having a health scare. Like I talked to you about this, you had cancer.
Yeah.
There was a time in my life a couple of years ago, I can't remember, when did you have the cancer?
2013.
You had testicular cancer.
Yeah.
And I remember quite well, I talked to you about this. I was riding down the highway, coming home from La Jolla Comedy Store. I hit a pothole on the highway. In the middle of the night doing like 90. I was like, man, that fucking hurt on my motorcycle. And over a period of 4 months, not having health care or anything, I had this amazing pain of just fire in my balls. And then I heard you had testicular cancer. I was like, man, I think I got cancer, but I don't have money to go. Finally, it gets so bad. It's like Thanksgiving a couple of years ago. Fuck this. I'm going in. I go in, and they go, well, the good news about testicular cancer is it doesn't hurt. Right. So you don't have that. They check me. They can't figure out. They say I got a bruised tailbone. That's a Kaiser for you.
So it's like sympathetic pain in your balls or something?
It takes another 6 months or so. Finally, the pain's so bad, I go to another doctor. He just puts his finger in my butt and goes, oh, dude, you got prostatitis. I go, what's that? And he goes, it's bruised prostate. Good thing about that is it doesn't cause cancer, so you don't have cancer. What happens is your prostate gets inflamed. The urine goes through it. It spills down into your balls. That's just acid. And then you have burning acid in your balls.
Sucks.
It was the worst. But my point is, the entire time I had this health scare, I was thinking, if I do have cancer, the last part of my life here, I've been doing exactly what I want to do. I wasn't at a dead-end job. I didn't have dead-end life. I was like, so I was going on stage every night. I didn't tell anybody, but with mad fucking pain. And I was riding to the places because I had no other way to get there.
Wow.
So he goes, take these vitamins. I go, that's not going to fucking work, vitamins, and boom. It's gone. It took a year and a half.
Wow.
But I'm totally better now, and I'm glad that you're here because I think you're a serious jewel.
Thanks.
In the comedy store and in the world, not
Thanks,
just there.
Man.
And I enjoy talking to you. And
likewise.
I'm still dying to see the puppet. I'm so fucking bummed. Everybody keeps talking about this.
This week. Maybe I'll bring it out this week, man.
Just text me when you do, though. I want to see it.
Yeah, I'll bring her out this week. This is a good week to do it.
And then please come see me again and talk on the show. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, man. Me too. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Where can we find you?
It's DuncanTrussell.com. That's my podcast. Or you can follow me on Twitter at DuncanTrussell.
You got a great website.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, it looks fucking good. And any road dates coming up?
Yeah, I'm doing a podcast tour in Texas and Austin, Dallas, and Houston. That's going to be on the 21st, 22nd, 23rd. And then if you go on my website, there's a bunch of dates coming up in March and in April in the Midwest and then New York. So they're all up there.
Well, I love you, man.
And love you back.
Thanks for coming down,
thanks,
dude. It was great. There he is right there. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Duncan Trussell. See you guys.